We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Hey there, Knicks fans. How you doing? It's your boy, Jonathan Macri, with you for another episode of the Knicks Film School Podcast. And, oh, wait, what's that? Oh, it's a sweet, sweet can of success. That's right. It is, well, it's not quite 20 years in the making because, you know, we had those couple of years, the one in particular, but man, I woke up today and it was a Monday and my paternity leave ended. I had to drag myself back into Brooklyn to the thing that I also do in addition to this. And I got to tell you, I had been dreading this day for a few weeks, but it was sweet. And it was sweet because you scroll down Twitter, you go on the internet, anywhere, you look outside your window, and it's just everybody. As I, it's actually, by the way, not a can of success. It was a can of Guinness, which I'm not pouring. Everybody is celebrating the New York Knicks. I am recording this, I should tell you, on Monday afternoon, this little introduction, which notably is before they play on Tuesday night. So hopefully when you are listening to this and you are listening to this episode, they will have won yet again. If not, you know what? Not the end of the world. Things are good. Things are good in Knicks land. And for real, though, when the entire basketball media apparatus kind of stops what it's doing and acknowledges the surprising success of one team in particular, and it seemed like that's kind of what everybody agreed to do after this past weekend, it means something. It means something to the organization. It means something to the fan base. It means something to the players. It means something to all of us. So, you know, they're not going to win every game for the rest of this year. Maybe that next loss came last night. Maybe it's going to come tonight. Maybe it's coming this weekend. Probably not winning the championship this year. Sorry to be a party pooper. But the point is, you know, this season, I think now, I don't want to jinx it, but it's hard to envision us sitting here a month or a month and a half or 2 months from now and not saying that this was really successful. So everybody, I hope you have taken the requisite time and brain space to soak it in and enjoy it as I take a sip of my celebratory Guinness, which I've been waiting all day to pour. Again, as I'm recording this just after I got home on Monday. So the episode that you are about to hear recorded last week, but it is just as pertinent as it was then because I am talking to our draft expert that we brought on this year, recommended by none other than Spencer Perlman himself, Jake Rosen. So you probably heard Jake on an episode a couple of months ago, kind of giving us the lay of the land very generally on the draft. And, you know, it was a good intro to the draft for people who may not have been that familiar with the prospects, the big time prospects yet. And if you want that primer, go back and check that episode out. I think it was towards the end of February. But this is going to be more Knicks specific, and even more specifically, this episode is very point guard specific. And we talk a lot about all the point guards who are slated to be drafted in the first round. We talk about the Baylor kids. We talk about some of the other guys. And Jake basically takes you through what's great about these players. As my daughter's yelling in the background, what's, you know, maybe not so great about these players, and also why, in his opinion, maybe going point guard in this draft is not the way to go. But I'll let him tell you why that is. We also talk about trades, what it would take to trade up, whether anybody's worth trading up for. We really run the gamut. So if you want a kind of middle-of-the-way Knicks draft primer before we get, like, right up to the draft, which, again, is going to be at the very end of July. We'll do one more of these episodes with Jake before then, but this is kind of an in-between period where it's like, okay, we know pretty much where the Knicks are going to draft, barring anything crazy at this point, and we know what their needs are. So let's get a little bit more in-depth than a general draft pod. So, Jake Rosen is coming up. We also do have a little bit of news. We have, we have an award to give out. It is an award not bestowed by the Knicks Film School team here, but by the National Basketball Association. And it is their Player of the Week Award, which was granted to one Julius Randle, thanks to his leading the Knicks to a 4-0 week. Two wins over the Pelicans, one win over the Mavericks, and a win over the hated Los Angeles Lakers. Over the course of those four games, he averaged over 35 points, over 8 rebounds, over 6 assists. And yeah, man, I mean, I don't know what you want me to say other than he has pushed himself very violently into the All-NBA discussion. That is a very real thing. And for anybody who wants a little bit more in-depth exploration of the numbers and facts and figures and advanced stats and comparisons between him and the other guys he's vying with for a spot on one of the All-NBA teams, check out Monday's Knicks Film School newsletter, which was completely free. I still do the once a week for free newsletter, and I go into all that. So congratulations to Julius Randle. Good job by him. And that is about it by way of news and notes. Just a reminder, again, you're listening to this on a Wednesday. The Knicks played last night. You're not going to hear me talk about that because as I'm recording this and as the episode was recorded, hasn't happened yet. But that doesn't mean you still can't hear some thoughts and analysis of that game. All you need to do is refresh your podcast feed, or if you prefer, go to YouTube and you could see the post-game live stream, which I am very happy to say Jeremy Cohen took on. I know it hasn't happened yet, but I could say confidently that he did a fantastic job on the live stream that is, again, taking place right after the Hornets game, and you could check out on your podcast feed or on YouTube. I think that is it. So without further ado, let us get to my conversation with our draft expert this year, Jake Rosen. Joining me now, very excited for this one. This is the second edition of the Knicks Film School. Let me think of an official name. The official Knicks Film School draft looking insight, other smart sounding words. And joining me for this draft season again, he is as good as it comes. When it comes to all things NBA draft, he is one of the hosts of the Prep to Pro pod with Max Carlin. You can find his stuff at jakeinthepaint.com. And as he just told me, and as I think I may have to join him now on Wednesday nights on Locker Room 9 Eastern, he co-hosts a draft show on Locker Room with Henry Ward. Welcoming back Jake Rosen. Jake, hello, sir. How are you?
I was doing great. I'm doing even better after that impressive introduction.
You're an impressive guy. What can I say?
Glad to be back. Talking draft is probably my favorite thing to do in the entire world. And what better to do it than through the lens of my favorite NBA team, the Knicks. We can get into it.
And you talk about the draft so much. So we got the first show out of the way, which was just like giving all of our the listeners kind of the broad strokes about the draft, and we focused on the top because at the time, I think I looked up, we recorded, I think, in the middle of February, middle to the end of February. And I think there was definitely, for me at least, some thought at that time that like, hey, we could still wind up in the top five. That is possible now, but the odds of that happening are, I think, very, very small. So I'm looking forward to being able to focus more on some Knicks-centric draft questions. And there are several. But before we get to those Knicks-centric draft questions, I'm going to start by asking you a general question, which you've probably been asked or thought about in the last – when did the tournament end? It's been a week and a half now, right?
Yeah, about a week and a half.
Yeah, about a week and a half. Any big changes for you in terms of your rankings, in terms of like, wow, I didn't think this guy was this or that, or like, man, this person really disappointed from the tournament that you came away with that like influenced your rankings or anything in a significant way?
So I've talked about this on Twitter. I've talked about this offline. It was actually one of the big hitting points of Henry and I's first show on Locker Room, which is basically to not overreact in either direction to the NCAA tournament.
And say why should you not do that?
At the end of the day, 40 minutes is 40 minutes and one sample size is one sample size. So I try to approach every game the same. Obviously, some opponents are going to carry more weight because it's more similar to NBA projection. But I remember when Ja Morant was coming out and he played Florida State, and for a skinny guard who made his money by attacking the rim, Florida State's probably the worst matchup you could ever get, especially in that Murray State team where there was basically one other guy that could handle the ball. And Ja had a really tough time. He ended up having a decent stat line box score wise because he hit a couple threes, but everyone knew that wasn't really his game, and his slashing kind of the flaws reared their heads. And I think a lot of people probably overreacted that game a little bit and tried to extrapolate that. Ja Morant, just one example. Guys in this class, Davion Mitchell, all of a sudden is the top 10 prospect.
You're stealing my next question. I can't. You're giving me the softball. I'm going to give it right back to you. This is great. Keep talking.
So I think the big names that trended in either direction this tournament are Davion Mitchell. And then to the negative side, I think Moses Moody has been catching a lot of flack, who I love dearly. And Franz Wagner ended on a very negative note as well. And basically what Henry and I were getting at in our locker room show is, look, it's okay to acknowledge that these guys didn't play their best games. We're not in the business of sweeping negative performances under the rugs and only paying attention to highlights. However, there's a time and a place and there's a space to actually contextualize why these performances looked the way they did. And for Franz and Moody specifically, Henry and I both talked about team context and matchup wise, and neither of those guys are prospects who are going to get theirs off the bounce reliably. That's just not their game. That's not their wiring. They're going to play within the flow of their team's offense. And in March, similar to the NBA playoffs, we see teams get stagnant down the stretch sometimes. And I think that's something that hurt both of those guys. And on the contrary, someone like Davion Mitchell, who was absolutely incredible and deserves all the credit in the world for his play, it doesn't take away the entire sample size of this season and everything in the past. And I think we're going to get to that because I think he's someone that you're definitely going to want to talk about. So we can talk him.
Let's get to him right now because
I've talked to Spencer a little bit offline, as maybe you have too, about Davion. And, you know, I like to cut to the point or cut to the chase. And I'm like, is he an NBA starting point guard? And Spencer has told me, no, he's not. He does nice things. And we'll talk about some of those nice things that he does. But no, he's not. He doesn't think he's an NBA starting point guard. And I'm also generally a very big fan of Jonathan Wasserman, and Jonathan Wasserman has been active on Twitter of late saying, like, the track record for older guys like this who go, you know, and like kind of pop and then enter the draft is not exactly sterling. So first let me ask you this. Where is Davion Mitchell on your board? If you're not an exact number, but like roughly where is he, or what tier?
He's around the 20, around 20, give or take a couple spots.
Okay.
Probably on the lower side. Like, I'm more comfortable in the low 20s rather than the mid to high teens. I wouldn't throw a fit if he went 18th or 17th. Okay. This is all about the draft. It's all about context. And for some teams, he'll make sense in the teens. Other teams, I wouldn't really even sniff him towards the late first. But, and it all varies. But for me personally, I'm most comfortable with him around 20. And there are some other guys that I just, in a vacuum, prefer.
What worries you more about him? Is it the ceiling or the floor, or should I frame that question in a different context?
Yeah. So, I mean, personally for me, I just think, I think the floor is probably getting a little bit overrated in my opinion.
Okay.
So he's old. So that explains the projection.
22.
The production. So
he's 22. Yeah, he's 22 now, right?
Let's see. Yeah, he's 22 now. So I said projection. I meant production.
Production. Yeah.
That you might be able to appoint the production to that, and
also, he's gonna be 23 by the time next season starts.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. All right. So that's pretty significant. So you just mentioned production. Production in years past was not this, obviously.
And yeah, so what I was basically getting at is I just think the role is a little bit more blurry than what people think. And I think, and you were getting at it with, look, is this guy starting point guard? And I would say no. His raw assist numbers are pretty good, but I think you still saw the struggles with him to make these layered reads where he's forced to read backside help. There's not a ton of manipulation there. Watching all the Baylor games, I think Butler, his teammate, is a superior passer by a pretty decent margin. And
we're going to talk about him soon.
Yeah. But the thing with Davion is that it was very easy for him the college game. His standstill burst is absolutely incredible. He is a ridiculous athlete with the frame, the lateral quickness, the way he's able to get downhill in a split second. And what you saw, especially this was true in the tournament, his ability to just draw easy rotations and create these windows for himself to make passing reads that aren't necessarily beyond complex. And you just have to wonder, does he have incredible NBA speed or does he have good NBA speed? And I think he has incredible college speed, and I think he is a top tier athlete, but I just am a little concerned with the lack of, we talk about this all the time, the lack of variance in the ways he creates advantages. It's not necessarily with his handle. It's not with change of pace. It's more just, I'm going to beat you because I'm faster than you. And that's okay. And that works, but I'm not fully comfortable banking that as my starting point guard. And another thing that I'm a little bit concerned about is the shooting.
I was about to ask. So the perimeter, there's, and again, I'm getting better at this. There's shooting on the perimeter, which we could talk about when I'm sure we'll mention Corey Kispert again. And then there's shot creation on the perimeter. So where I'm more concerned about where is the shot creation at with Davion Mitchell?
So I personally think Davion is one of those guys where he's a shot maker. I don't necessarily think he's a shooter. He has incredible space creation methods. The jab step, the sides. He had one, I forgot which game it was, but at the end of the half in one of those games where he just ISO'd and you knew he was going to a hang dribble three, but pulled out a nasty space creation combo before he took it. And I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but if I can recall correctly, I think at Auburn, he was around a 28% three-point shooter in his first year.
Okay.
Then last year at Baylor, I think he was around 32%. And now he's up to 44%, which is just a drastic leap. And also you have to look at the free throw percentage, which I think is a pretty decent indicator.
It's in the 60s, really, right? Split.
Yes. And he has consistently been in the 60s throughout his entire college career. So I'm not one who's, who's going to really split hairs over free throw percentage. I'm not going to say, oh, a guy can or can't shoot because he's shooting 73% and the other guy's shooting 77%. But at some point for a guard, there is a number where I'm willing to raise some eyebrows, and his consistency for 3 years straight of being around 64% is a little worrisome to me. And that's where I think, you know, you get this more of a, he's a shot creator and a tough shot maker, which is valuable. And there is a place for that. And I don't want to seem like I'm just ripping him to shreds, because I do think he carves out a role in the league.
The hype train has him as a top 10 pick. And that's, you know, you need to be have a certain ceiling in my view, especially in a draft like this, which I still think is overall a pretty good draft, to warrant that. And it's, I think you're just putting it into context.
Yeah. I do think he carves out a role in the league. It's just not something I'm willing to spend a top 10 pick on. And that's kind of what I'm getting at.
Okay. His teammate, you mentioned him before. So again, referencing Spencer, who's much smarter than I will ever be, has told me he prefers Butler to Mitchell out of the two for Baylor. And my impression just watching them, and I've watched them, I don't know, probably a 20th as much as you have, is that I see more of a point guard in Butler, and maybe there are some things that he can't do that Mitchell can, but if you're asking me right now, I would rather have Butler. So I'll ask the same to you. Who would you rather have and why?
Yeah, I definitely prefer Butler. And a reason for that is, and you hit the nail on the head, the biggest improvement. Butler made two huge strides over this offseason. I wrote about it earlier on when it was very apparent. And the two big strides he made as a true point guard and as a facilitator and as a lead guard, making nuanced reads, the layered reads that I talked about that Davion wasn't necessarily making. Butler is making those on a regular basis. He has and this is someone who as a sophomore was a little erratic as a decision maker and was kind of viewed as a combo and a defensive negative. I was still a fan and I would have taken him in the late first if he had declared as a sophomore.
Really?
So
okay.
He came back and all those, the calling cards with him were still there. The off-ball shooting, the ability to play on and off, scalable in the backcourt. And just he completed this pick and roll arsenal. And now he's not just a scorer, he's a facilitator. And the things that he was doing to drop bigs in college basketball is just borderline unfair and criminal. The bag he has, I think I would probably say he has the best handle in the draft.
You really know exactly where I'm going, because, like, again, I'm watching. So let's, you know, as an example, Emmanuel Quickley has figured out ways to penetrate the defense, but he needs a screen to do it. And once he gets into the teeth of a defense, we're still waiting to see if he could make those advanced reads and make those advanced passes. It seems like Butler is a guy who's going to be really good on the pick and roll. But now you're telling me with the handles that maybe there's even more than him as a pick and roll penetrator, or am I misreading that?
So the problem with Butler is without a ball screen, everything's a little bit difficult because he's a poor athlete. I wish somehow we could combine his skill set and arsenal with Davion Stanstill Burst. And we're talking about a lead guard that could take the Knicks to another level. Yeah. But nonetheless, no prospect is perfect. And that's what you're getting with Butler. It's honestly, what do you prefer and what you're willing to bank on? I personally trust that guards that are as skilled as Butler and he's already very seasoned and he knows he's never been the best athlete. And so he knows how to compensate. We saw this with someone like Malachi Flynn in last year's draft. Malachi has never been the best athlete and he still isn't the best athlete.
Not a bad fourth quarter last night. He hit 5 threes.
and Malachi is starting to really figure things out in the NBA. And yeah, we're seeing that stop start, the change of pace, the craft finishes. And it's not easy. The finishes with Butler, and I am nervous about him around the rim. That's something I wrote about back in December, January, whenever I published that. And those issues still hold true. He'll get blocked at the rim. He does rely. And unlike Davion, he can't just elevate and go. It has to be crafty. It has to be skilled. It has to be deceptive. And that's sort of what you're looking at. And that's kind of where he shares with Quickley is. I think that's my biggest long-term concern with Quickley is him getting to the rim and finishing there instead of just settling in the in-between area. And that's what I will say with Butler is he is good getting there. He has floaters. He has a little pull-up, but he doesn't settle as much as I think most people would assume.
Okay. And the shooting, is he an elite shooter? Is he just a sub-elite shooter? Where do you have it?
So I don't know if he's an elite shooter, but he's a very damn good one. And okay. Again, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but he's been consistent throughout his time at Baylor. And what I love most is his versatility. He's comfortable pulling up with his left or right hand, which is something that I think is noteworthy for those people who have really played basketball or really notice. Righties pulling up off their right hand, it's not as comfortable at all. People are very comfortable doing that little hang dribble, like Michael Porter Jr. special, a little hang dribble with your left. Yeah. And you get into his 1-2 and it flows very easily. Butler, multiple pull-ups with his right hand with goofy footwork that he's comfortable with. And with Butler, it's just all, I don't want to say, like, I hate when people say, oh, he's a gym rat, but like you can tell everything has been wrapped and wrapped and wrapped. And he's just very comfortable with things that to other people are unorthodox, but to him, that's how he wins. And that's probably my favorite part about his game, is that he's comfortable taking the alternate route because he knows that's how he's going to beat the defense. Because there are ways when he gets bottled up, and he had a couple games in the tournament where he didn't look great, honestly. And those athleticism, or the lack of athleticism, was probably the main culprit behind that. But that's not to say that there aren't ways to compensate.
Okay. We don't spend a lot of time on this, but just very briefly, do you think that there, like when he comes into the league, is he a guy that you would personally think will be ready to contribute, you know, to a decent rotation fairly fast?
Yeah, I mean, playing point guard as a rookie is probably one of the hardest jobs in basketball. However, I think Butler is someone who you could rely on to be in the rotation because he has such a translatable skill set. It's going to take a little bit of time for him to adjust to the extra level of physicality, the extra length, the extra speed, all NBA athletes, all things that rookies have to generally adjust to. But in the end, I do think you have a bankable skill set to contribute at some level. And that's, people have the turnoff with Butler is that he doesn't have such a high ceiling, but I think that stuff kind of gets overblown sometimes. And there are good gambles. And I think there's someone in this class that I think represents that.
Well, we're
at the league spot. And I'm sure.
I wonder if it's the same guy that I have in mind. Actually, it's probably not the same guy that I have in mind. But we're gonna get to a gamble in a little bit.
I do think Butler is a safer play in this class. He can, like I said, he can go on and off the ball. He has NBA range. He has a pick and roll bag. He can play. I know he can play an NBA pick and roll from day one. That I am very confident in.
But it's like, if you're going to give me a safe player who could shoot. Give me a safe player who could run a pick and roll, and give me a safe player who can handle the ball. And who can play defense and defend his position. Like, that's the safe.
Yeah. So that was. That was another thing from Butler this year. He definitely took a big step on the defensive side. He, by no means is he Davion Mitchell. He doesn't necessarily overwhelm at the point of attack, but completely can hold his own, which wasn't necessarily the case at all times last year, and shown some instinctual and anticipatory reads in by jumping passing lanes here and there, making timely digs. He's not Davion. I'm not chalking him up to be. He's not Jaden Springer. He's not one of the elite guard defenders in the draft, but considering where he was at as a sophomore and where I was at with him as a sophomore, again, it's just another step in the right direction.
So you brought up one of the names. So I was going to throw a couple names at you, and you tell me where you – well, actually, maybe I should ask you this. Who is the top point – after Suggs, who's your top point guard on your board?
I am holding my Sharif Cooper stock. Contrary to other people, I'm standing pat. It's not as clean cut as I thought it was. And there are a couple reasons for that.
What are they?
The shooting is tough.
That's a kind word for it.
It can keep me up at night sometimes. Not actually, but if I were a GM, it would. And I do think there are avenues, and we just had PD Webb on our podcast to talk about this. And I'm not one to totally buy into the whole touch thing as the only indicator, but I do think it means something. And with Sharif is basically the craziest touch lob passer I've seen at the college level. The touch, the placement, the anticipation, obviously anticipation doesn't have anything to do with it, but I think there is something to be said for the smoothness he's able to throw these live drill passes with, especially the lobs towards the rim, and maybe extrapolating that into shooting improvement. But it goes without saying the mechanics need to get overhauled. And that's it. If you don't trust your player development staff to treat those mechanics, then I wouldn't even draft him, to be honest. I think that's where you need to be at, because it does need to be overhauled. Because with Sharif, we're talking about a clear defensive negative, and there's no way around that. He's probably 5'11 at best, scrawny. He's never going to be able to provide positive value, even guarding other point guards. You're going to bleed value there.
If you're talking ceiling, and I think it's, well, I was just going to say, this front office and I guess this coaching staff by extension seems to really value work ethic, because if it's one thing Obi Toppin has had, I don't know if it's a rookie year from hell, but he has not had a great rookie year. The work ethic seems to be there. They all are still praising how, you know, he's watching film and this and that. And Emmanuel Quickly, they talked about him coming in great conditioning. He seems to be a gym rat to use your term that you used before. Randall got himself, like, clearly they are placing value on this as a trait that they want to build this Knicks, you know, infrastructure around. Like, we want guys that work hard. So, does the fact that Cooper is like such a bad defender, is that just based on his size? Do you see signs that he's just like, he's dogging it, or like where is he a bad defender?
I mean, I think the effort. Sharif has never been someone who's buying in completely on defense, and a lot of that can be attributed to the offensive load that he's carried at every single level. I don't know what his usage was, but I think it was in the mid to high 30s.
I'll pull it up right now.
This year. Yeah. Just anecdotally, anything, he did everything for them, and it, with a ball screen, without a ball screen. And the reason why I do think there is a ceiling outcome for Cooper, 33.1% usage.
My God.
I think the assist percentage is also like nuts there too.
He had a 50 assist percentage for a while, I think.
Yeah. So with Cooper, the ceiling outcome is that you have someone who is able to just, because of his quick twitch, his handle, his ability to just get into tight spaces and eat up paint touches, combined with the passer that he is and the reads and the cable, like he's capable of throwing every single pass in the book. And more importantly, he makes every read, and it's all on the fly. Nothing is predetermined. His turnovers are ambitious. I don't want to say he's just trying things, because that gives him too much benefit of the doubt, but the turnovers aren't, his turnovers are rarely because he predetermined to read and didn't react. It's because he's reacting so quickly and then getting too ahead of himself, which it's important to contextualize all these things. And that's something I'm willing to live with. Now, the downside is, and this was pretty evident in the Kentucky game, and I've talked with a couple of people about this, the length can bother him at times because he is very small and he's a poor athlete.
It sure
and
did in that game. I remember watching that
the game at Kentucky was brutal. It was very rough. Worst game of the year, pretty clearly. And like I said, like, you don't want to overreact to one game, the John Morant Florida State game that we talked about. But it is worth noting that I don't think Sharif is more than 5'11. I think he's probably legit 5'11, maybe 6 feet. And so the margin for error, you just have to embrace it, that the margin for error is very thin. And he's likely not someone, because of the role he needs to play as this ball dominant guard with questionable shooting. And he's going to derive his value from being on the ball and playmaking for others and getting into the paint, running pick and rolls. He's going to need possessions to give the value that he needs. So the median outcome for him is really interesting to think about, because
there is no, he's either a guy who's probably not going to be helping an NBA team at all, or he can be a transcendent, like, top 10 starting point guard
That's kind of what I'm getting at. And I hate the term boomer bust, because I do think high ceiling often results in high floor. But with him, it's really interesting, because if he's not this ball dominant point guard that he's always been, what role does he slide into? And
when do you draft that guy? When would you draft him if you know?
I think he's probably the guy that varies most based on team infrastructure. Okay. Like, if I was PD has tweeted this, like, if I was the Spurs, he's a get for me, an absolute get. Talk about one of the.
If you're a basketball junkie, then you know there's no better time of year than the NBA playoffs. Twice a week, J.J. Redick is cooking on his podcast, The Old Man and the Three. He has guys come on in all stages of their careers to talk about the league and share stories you won't hear anywhere else, including Devin Booker on why he talks so much trash, Ray Allen's epic free throw competitions with LeBron in Miami, and the moment Tyrese Halliburton knew Pascal Siakam would be a good fit in Indy. In addition to player interviews, every Monday, JJ breaks down the top three things happening around the NBA with unmatched analysis, not outlandish takes, and is often joined by masterminds of the game like Tim Legler to dive deep on rookie reports, trade breakdowns, and why is mean mugging now a tech? You won't find another outlet that covers the game as comprehensively and with such insight as JJ does it on The Old Man and the Three. Make this your companion podcast during the playoffs. Listen to The Old Man and the Three ad-free on Wondery Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
Premier shooting development staffs in the entire league, and more importantly, they have the current roster to surround him and isolate him with all these wings.
They have a lot of really good players.
Keldon, DeJounte. I mean, talk about defensive guards that can cover up for him at the guard spot between Derek White and DeJounte, and then the guys on the wings, Keldon, Vassell, and just all those guys who can help insulate him and make him bleed as little value as possible.
I usually hate and when people say like, oh, if the Spurs, but this makes perfect sense. It really is.
And for once, it's not an international guy. We're talking about an American guy.
Thank you for that, Sharif. I think that's a perfect encapsulation of him. So, okay, we talked about him. We talked about the two Butler guys. And the other guys I was going to ask you about in terms of point guards, I was going to ask you about Trey Mann. And I was going to ask you about, Springer, we talked about last time. I don't really know what else there is to say about Springer. Where is he on your board roughly?
Springer's one of the more mind-boggling cases in terms of mainstream hype.
What is mind-boggling about it to you?
So he's currently on ESPN's board. He's at 28.
Okay.
Which makes no sense to me. I have him as a clear-cut top 10 guy. I can't find 10 guys in this class that I'd rather have. And he's someone that I'm pretty fascinated by for the Knicks, honestly. And there's a couple of reasons for that.
And can I just give you my quick take?
Go 100%. Hit me.
This is having a 50th of what you have, but I did tune into Tennessee a few times this year. And that team felt like if there's a situation where we were to look back in a few years and be like, wow, we really didn't see anything that this guy, they kept the handcuffs on, not, you know, maybe the handcuffs on the guy, but like, it just felt like we weren't seeing what he was capable of in that particular situation. Am I misreading that?
Yeah. And it was that team context was tough. And I feel like they were just never as good as anyone thought they were, evident by them getting run off the floor in the first round of the NCAA tournament. And the thing with Springer is that he's 18 years old. Everyone knows he's youngest American in the class. And that matters. I'm not someone who is going to necessarily split hairs between a 19-year-old and a 21-year-old or a 21-year-old and a 20-year-old. I think at that point, it's somewhat the same. But when someone is extremely young for their age and is a legit productive and plus player in the SEC on both ends of the floor, that's noteworthy to me. And the thing with him is he was bullying guys as an 18-year-old. He was winning with strength. He's moving guys. He's dropping his shoulder. So just imagine when he's 24 and he's had six more years in the NBA strength and conditioning stat. Like,
his hype tapes in high school were fucking crazy.
Yeah. And the thing with Springer is that it's unorthodox, and I think that rubs people the wrong way. Everyone likes to see it traditional, and he's not traditional by any sense. He plays off of 2 feet from 8 feet and in for these little push shot floaters and pull ups. He plays off 2 feet at the rim. He's a power athlete. He's not necessarily explosive in the half court. I guess that's the stigma around him. I would argue that he's definitely more explosive than he gets credit for. The power that Henry and I were talking about this on text, like the power that he's able to generate getting downhill in his lower body, and then the control to stop on a dime and contort his body around help. He has special, unique athletic traits, but, and it's actually something I'm writing about whenever I get the time, is These traits aren't traditional, so people don't know how to identify them. But body control and stop start and the ability to play off of two and avoid help is just as valuable as your vertical leap, if not more valuable, because that's the way, that's actual functional tools that are going to help you in a real game. How often do you get the chance to take six dribbles and four full length strides en route to doing a windmill dunk in a real game? You don't. It doesn't happen. So as cool as these combined vertical leaps and the Cassius Stanley post workout dunks, they're cool, but they don't represent functional athleticism. And I think Jaden Springer probably epitomizes functional athleticism more than anyone in the class. And honestly, the big reason why I'm very into him is I'm not so sold on any lead handlers in this class. Like, I still would like Sharif at one of the picks.
So wait, you have Sharif higher than Springer,
Springer's higher than Sharif.
Springer's higher than Sharif. Okay,
on my board. Okay. There are teams that I think Sharif might be more of a get, but I'm way more comfortable with Springer.
Okay,
and it took me a while to get around to that. Ben Pfeiffer has been bullying me for 5 months to get around to that. I'm finally there, and it's just because Jane Springer is just, it's like something I don't really want to overthink. It's kind of all right in front of you. Okay. And that's why I'm a little bit mind boggled about the hype, is that you have someone who's going to be a legit two-way combo guard who has creation equity and upside. And basically the one thing that needs to come around for him for it to all work is the catch and shoot jumper.
But the percentage is good this year, right? On his three.
So very low volume.
I know, very, it's like less than two a game.
Very, very selective with the attempts. He had a couple, I think the game against Kentucky at home where he was gunning and I was watching it live and I was like, whoa, like this is something. And I think if you look at his game log, he had a stretch where he got much more aggressive from three. I haven't watched Tennessee in a little bit just because I was pretty much watching their, like, I was in a routine for about 3 weeks of like Tennessee played, I'd watch a game the next morning. Could not get enough of those guys. So I've just cooled off their tape a little bit. But from what I can remember is he had a couple game stretch where he was much more aggressive, whether that was from catch and shoot, that was getting to a spot and pulling up. So I think it is there at some point. It's just going to take a little bit to get out. But again, we're talking about someone who's incredibly smart, possesses great positional strength, as an unorthodox way of getting paint touches and creating advantages. And we're just waiting on one of the easier skills to develop to make the whole thing worthwhile.
That's a bet you could make. Last time I'm going to mention Spencer. I'm fairly certain, maybe it's changed, but I think Spencer has Trey Mann 6 on his board overall, which is way higher than anybody else that I've seen. So from Florida, I believe, is he's a sophomore? Am I getting that right?
He is a sophomore. Yes.
He's a sophomore, 20-year-old sophomore. The shooting really was nice towards the end of the year. He finished with a nice stat line towards the end of the year. Where are you on Trey Mann?
So Trey Mann is someone that I'm writing about Trey Mann and Jaden Springer. So this is perfect. And Trey Mann also
all
fits
the point guards. Let's get all the point guards in the pool. Fine.
So Trey Mann, on top of the shooting, which we'll certainly get to, he fits this functional athleticism idea that I'm talking about, and is that he's slender. He doesn't get any vertical pop. I think he has zero dunks on the year yet. He's able, this combination of his handle is absolutely wicked, but what makes the handle so functional and productive in a real game is his footwork and his ability to sell these moves. He is so shifty and loose and just like very elusive as a handler. And every in and out starts with a huge shoulder dip going to the other direction. Every snatch back starts with a real hard plant going downhill. Every move is prefaced with something that screams, I'm doing this, before he counters back. And that's why it's so functional. And all these things working together brings this to this functional athleticism, where his just the unique body movements, the stop start, the change of pace. It's, again, it's unorthodox. It's not something
that how is he? Is he good at the rim? Is he getting to the line? Like, where's that part of it?
So recently he's been much more aggressive getting to the rim and getting to the line. He's initiating contact. He's lengthy. And this is someone who really caught my eye at McDonald's All-American Week when he was a senior, and they were doing ones, and it was him, Maxi, and Nico Mannion were doing ones in the half court. Okay. And Trey Mann was just getting to all these scoop finishes, same goofy leg, high up off the glass, great. Like, he has incredible touch. Okay. Floaters, scoop finishes, pull-up jumpers, you name it. And he's going to struggle at the rim just because he's a poor traditional athlete. Yeah. He doesn't get a ton of lift. I don't know if he's going to be able to initiate contact with NBA bigs right off the jump. He probably is not going to get those calls that he's getting right now. Okay. But there have been some encouraging flashes that weren't there earlier in the season. But the calling card is absolutely the space creation and the shooting. And the shooting is nuclear. I think he's
nuclear.
Yes. Absolutely. The off the dribble shooting.
I'm sold.
I ran through these numbers with Henry. I put together a little database from Bartorvik, and it was basically shots at the rim, shots in mid range, and shots from three, volume, percentages, and percent unassisted. And last year, the leader in the clubhouse for unassisted threes was Jordan Ford, who had 44% of his. He was only assisted on 44% of his threes. And
okay.
For people who don't know, Jordan Ford was small guard from St. Mary's. Anecdotally, I felt like he was getting everything off of pull-ups, and he was at 44%. Anthony Edwards was like 46 or 47%. Okay. Trey Mann, I haven't been able to find anyone close to him historically. I've looked at Dame. I looked at Jimmer. I guess Jimmer did a little bit more off ball. I tried to think of every like nuclear shooter in the past, and I got Isaiah Ken, I think, was the closest I came to. And Isaiah Ken was at like in the 30s. He was in the high 30s somewhere. More of the story, Trey Mann is at 33% of his makes are assisted. So only one out of three of his makes are assisted. And keep in mind, these aren't just easy pull-ups. Like, he's not getting a Simmons sag. This is him. These are all self-created jumpers with his handle and his size and the quick trigger. Spencer was bombarding me in our locker room session last week. What are you missing? Yeah. The passing is good, but not great. The finishing is interesting. I trust him there to an extent. Just tough because it's similar to Butler and these guards that aren't good athletes. It's all compensation finishes and it's all crafty footwork. It's all extension, high up off the glass, touch, all things like that. So I don't think he's going to be bad at the rim, but I don't think he's ever going to be good, if that makes sense. And defense. Defensively, he's more of a neutral guy.
But he's not Cooper.
He's not Cooper, no. Okay. And he's also 6'5", so there's that.
You're selling me. You may not even be trying it, but you're selling me, Trey Mann.
I mean, listen, he's really damn good. There's no way really around it.
Like, so I'll take a chance on the guy that can get to the rim, figuring out how to be in the 50th percentile of rim finishes for his position. Yep. If the shooting is there and he gets there, you don't need it to be more than 50th, 45th percentile. So it's not 15th percentile or 20, like that. That's what I'm being sold by right now.
Yep. So the biggest thing for me, and this is what I've analyzed most in depth, is his passing. And his passing is really interesting because if you remember last year to Kyrie Lewis, and it's really easy to just comp them together, Kyrie Lewis wasn't necessarily making the most impressive reads. Yeah. It was more about his functionality and his ability to just throw these live drill passes with both hands, whether it's a skip, a lay down, whatever, you name it, he could do it. And he didn't, because of that and his speed, he had that blow by speed where he could just get past his primary every time. And similar to Davion, obviously it's not as outlier, but he was drawing the same type of rotations. And in the Pelicans game I've watched, that isn't betraying him. He's still getting downhill very quickly and getting good looks for teammates. So with Mann, he shares a lot of the same functionality. He can throw these skip passes with both hands. He's 6'5", so he can see over the defense in terms of smaller guards. But where he struggles is he's very locked into his one read. And he can manipulate the defense when it's two on one. That's when I've seen his manipulation, where he can sell the floater and then do a drop off or Euro step towards the corner.
I think
he's going up and then drop off. So it's simple manipulation. And the part that it just doesn't sit. The only part that doesn't sit well with me, but I am optimistic about the passing. The only part that doesn't sit well with me is that most of his turnovers in the game that I watched for the piece came from just being locked onto the first read and forcing it into a tight window when there was a weak side skip open. And sometimes he's a little bit ambitious in trying to fit in windows to the roller when he could just wait a split second and then skip it to the corner. So the layered reads, I keep using that word, aren't necessarily there getting to your second and third progressions. I would like to see that more from him. But like I said, no prospect's perfect, and you got to take what you can get and project development and hope to extrapolate. So with Mann, the only reason I'm not as confident in the passing as with Kyra is I knew that he would be able to create these advantages and draw rotations from the jump because of that blow by speed. Mann is more complicated because he relies on change of pace, the handle, maybe a ball screen here or there, pull up gravity. He has avenues to draw these rotations. It's just not as clean cut as was with Kyra.
Okay. I didn't bring up Giddy. I hope I'm pronouncing his last name.
Giddy.
I've not watched the second of him. He's for anybody who doesn't know, he's an international player. Apparently he's had a nice season. I just don't think the Knicks are going to draft an international guy. I'm just throwing that right out there.
I don't know if Giddy's someone I've only watched two games of. So I don't have a ton to say. I've literally only watched two games, which is pretty minimal compared to everyone else we've talked about so far, just because I don't have access to, like, I just found out that they were on Twitch. So I'll be getting around to him soon. But with Giddy, he is a pretty wild passer. The playmaking and the reads, the defensive manipulation, it's all there. He literally just, in the game I watched, and I was joking around with PD about this after he recorded, he had his jersey untucked from the tip. And I don't know why that meant so much to me, but that was like the vibe that I felt he was playing with. Just like, look, I'm just out here hooping. Like, I'm going to try shit. Like, it might not work, but like, I'm going to try everything. And
it's cool.
The windows, he's like, I don't remember if I follow some NBA NFL draft stuff like pretty vaguely. And I've seen like something knock with Justin Fields. Like, Justin Fields is an incredibly accurate passer. And I think I saw one tweet. I could be completely making this up, but like the point will stand anyways. And basically the thing with Fields is that he knows how accurate he is and he knows how capable he is in like the short to mid range. So he's just like extremely ambitious and fitting the ball into these tight windows that he probably shouldn't go for. Okay. That's how I feel about Giddy. Like, Giddy knows he can make every single pinpoint pass on the court. And some of the plays he was making are just like otherworldly passing. So, and I'm pretty I'm more optimistic on the shot. It seems like, I don't think he's like a 40% 3-point shooter, but it seems like the cold stretch that he got off to was more of an outlier bad stretch of games rather than the type of shooter he actually is. The shooting coming around would be huge because I don't really view him as this primary ball handler, and that's okay. He's a very poor athlete with standstill burst. The handle is not good at all. So there's just no real avenue for him to necessarily create consistent advantages on the ball, but you don't need to do that when you're 6'9", and he is a legit 6'9". So I think he's going to be really, really interesting to sort of play this linking role. Okay. And the great thing about him is that he sees everything one step ahead. And for his, and I had a clip from one of the games I watched, he made a ridiculous plus one, but like, it wasn't a traditional, like, skip it around the perimeter. It was, he caught the ball and then threw an absolute bullet to the roll man and in a tight window. And that's the stuff that Tyrese Haliburton does so well, passing off the ball, anticipating before, knowing where you're going to go with it before the ball even gets to you. Gotcha. So right when you touch it, it's hot potato, and not in a bad way. So Giddy is pretty fascinating and someone I definitely need to dig into more, but he's going to be really interesting. And that's kind of all I can say right now.
So we've just talked. I mean, it's funny. The reason I didn't bring up Suggs is because, you know, again, Suggs is Suggs. We don't need to talk about him. But in addition to Suggs, we've just now talked about, you know, 6 guys. That's a lot of point guard possibilities. Is there anybody who we haven't talked about that is on your point guard radar as a guy that, like, you know, watch out for this guy or something?
So at this point, I honestly just feel like the Knicks are never going to find a long-term point guard. I just don't know if it's ever going to happen.
Ye of little faith.
I don't know if it's just ever going to happen. And this is what I will say is the Knicks have been incredibly fun this year. And while I don't, this isn't the draft, especially where our picks are going to end up 15 and 20 around there. This isn't a draft that's going to instantly take us over the top. So I am not one to rush rebuilds. We finally have an infrastructure that I'm actually somewhat, I have some faith in. Like RJ Barrett is going to be a good NBA wing. I with Julius Randle, I'm not fully sure. Julius Randle, I'm not fully sure what the long-term role is. I think he probably needs to get scaled down a little bit once we get ultra competitive.
In a perfect world,
because
yeah, we'll get there.
Yeah, I'm get there. And but that will be trouble in paradise for any Knicks fan if we have to worry about scaling Julius Randle down to a real playoff series. But basically, what we're getting at is you have guys that can initiate some offense. I trust RJ Barrett to initiate some offense. I trust Julius Randle to initiate some offense. Emmanuel Quickley, to an extent, yes. I don't know. The jury's still kind of out there.
I think he's a sixth man at this point. Yeah, I'm calling it. I think he's a sixth man. I think he's gonna be a really good sixth man. That's what.
That's kind of where I've been all along, and I hated the times where I thought where people called me the biggest pessimist in the world for saying that. But
if you're a good sixth man on a good team, that's
and with the 25th or late 20s, whatever it was,
massive important player. That's a guy that could. Anyway, we don't talk about
Michael Quickley. So basically, what I'm kind of getting at is I don't really know if there's anyone. Like while I'm very enticed with Trey Mann and the possibilities he could bring to the Knicks, Shreve Cooper, very enticed, and it's looked like he's going to be around in that range. I'm not sure if I'm ready to just go for the primary initiator gamble. Or I hate using the word primary initiator. Guard.
So well, let's finish up here. Let's call it right now. How optimistic am I feeling today? It's the 16th and the 21st pick. Those are the picks. It's 16 and 22 or 21 and 33. Like those are your picks. You're on. It's draft night. Like what are you in your dream world? What do you want them to do? What do you hope they can do? Like what would would you be trying to move up? Would you be, just like where's your mindset for
so that? I definitely wouldn't be trying to move up if those were the picks, because I personally don't really see a difference past 8, 9. I think the guys from 10 or 11 on through 30 are.
So let me stop you for a second. Yeah. You don't think that they could get into the top? I know that I wasn't even going to ask you if they get into the top five. Even think they could get into the top 8 or 9.
Maybe they could, but if we're moving up to get Scottie Barnes or Jalen Johnson, I would much rather take two swings at 15 and 20. Without a doubt. I think that is the sort of capital. I remember a couple of years back, Kings and Blazers did a trade. I think it was like 20 and 15 for 10.
It was 15. It was the Collins trade. It was 10 for 15 and 20. Yeah.
Yep. So I think that's sort of the capital that you're looking at that point. Springer is going to be on the board. I think Springer is, if those are the picks, I think Springer is probably the number one priority for me.
So you're taking multiple swings, and I tend to agree with you. I'm with you. I don't see unless Keon John, and we talked about Keon Johnson last time, unless they really think Keon Johnson is going to be, I don't know what the comp is for him, whatever. Unless they're super high on Keon Johnson, he's the only guy that I personally see as like, ooh, we need to go up and get that guy. But
yeah, I mean, so the other than Keon, the guys at 5, 6, 8, 9 on my board are all guys that are looking like they're going to be available from 16 to 20. And so in my mind, why waste 2 picks and move up for someone that I don't even value in that range? If in an ideal scenario, let's say we're at 16 and 20, I would love to get 2 out of the 4 group of Springer, Zaire Williams, Moses Moody, or Franz.
I was going to ask you, I'm like, give me your preferred guys that are not point guards. I knew you were going to say Moody. I knew you were going to say Franz. I'm happy you said Zaire, because
Zaire is someone that I think when all the dust settles, I'm going to end up really coming back around on.
He just looks the part. And I know it didn't come together, but
so the thing with Zaire, and after once the nuclear shooting started to die down, you saw what it was going to look like. And there was no way he wasn't going to gain 20 pounds in a week. Those struggles were going to be the same. His freshman year was going to look the same in its entirety.
Yeah.
But the thing with Zaire is he already gets the hard stuff. He already knows how to get to a one dribble pull up. The mechanics are clean. He's already knows how to be a complimentary passer. He already knows how to rotate on the backside and be a plus team defender. It's the little stuff that will get unlocked as he puts on weight. And I just think that's a bet that I'm continually getting higher and higher on, especially when you can consider the rest of the class. And it's also
I think some team is going to talk themselves into him high.
Yeah, no, I agree. But it just based on, it seems like there's a consensus top five, which I don't disagree.
We know that,
I don't agree with at all. But there's a consensus top five with the two G League guys, Cade, Mobley, and Suggs.
Okay, I'll bite before we finish up on Zaire. Why don't you agree with the top five?
You want to do this now?
Let's do it now. Come on.
Jonathan Kuminga.
Oh, okay. That's fine. I think we talked about Kuminga a little bit last time.
Last time I was on the pod, I was anti-Green, pro-Kuminga, and that has taken a complete 180.
Really?
Yeah. Complete 180 between those two guys. Green is the real deal. I think so.
Sure seems like it to me from the G League games that I watched.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a legit scoring off guard who is a ridiculous athlete, and we can kind of leave it at that because I think I don't even want to think about it because
we don't need to, but yeah. No, I think but when we talked, the G League season hadn't, maybe they'd played a game,
they had played like two games, it was like two games,
yeah, and so
it was like was a quick knee-jerk reaction. But anyways, you know what I was kind of getting at is that so those five guys are already going.
Yeah.
That's relatively settled. Scotty Barnes is going to go high. A team will fall in love with him. I'm very confident in that. Jalen Johnson seems to have held up his stock somehow, some way, in the back end top 10.
Yeah.
We're just not going to get into that.
We don't need to talk about
and that. Keon Johnson seems to have held up his stock. Davion Mitchell is getting a ton of buzz, and all of a sudden you're looking at like 10 or 11 and these guys are sneakily on the board. And
I mean, Moody's not going to drop that far.
I don't think Moody drops that far. ESPN dropped him to like 24 after the tournament, which yeah.
That's stupid. The kid's 19. He's not 19. He's 18 actually still.
So I think Moody is probably gone. Franz, I am not sure. I think if we can get up to like 14, I think we might have a shot. But okay. Springer's going to be there, it seems like. And I think that's sprinting to the podium with him. and then Zaire. Zaire's going to be interesting. I think Zaire probably is one of the wider draft ranges
on
draft night. Like you said, the team could pick him at six. And all right, run with it. Like, you trust your training conditioning staff, I'm all in. Like there's just an avenue where that works. And I'm not comfortable saying that about everyone in this class.
Okay. All right. This has been great. Hold on one more. I have to get this because I didn't ask about him last time. And this is now, if I don't ask about him now, I'm going to kick myself because, as I said, the Knicks are going to have the 33rd, 32nd, 33rd, whatever pick. At the beginning of the season, before they played any basketball games, BJ Boston was.
I'm glad.
I have to.
I thought about throwing BJ in at for 20. In that group for 20.
Interesting.
And it's just
he was know. For it's, anybody who didn't watch any Kentucky this year. He was. I'll say it. He was a fucking atrocity. He was
I mean, it was. And I've said if BJ. Like, if EJ turns out to be like a good NBA wing, like I'm lost at that point because it was so bad. And
yeah,
but I can't quit it. I really can't. And at some point, like he's worth it. I'm sorry.
There's going to be a point where he's
absolutely worth it. If he's there at 32, I'm very into that. Something happens with the Mavs pick and they get to 22. I'd be into him at 22. I mean, the guys that I have in that range right now, I'm looking at BJ, Josh Christopher. This is in like the low 20s. BJ, okay. Josh Christopher, Deuce McBride, Kessler Edwards, TJ Shen's around there, Garuba. But Garuba and the Knicks, I don't really see that with our front court overload. But okay. Any one of those wings, like I'm really into taking a shot on one of those wings, whether it's Kessler, whether it's Terrence Shen, and like with all three picks, honestly, because basically what I'm getting at is like, I don't see the lead guard that's going to be there for us and be our guy. Okay. So why waste the pick swing for the fences when you can just continue to add to the infrastructure? And it's the same flawed philosophy that kind of landed us Obi instead of Devin Vassell, which I won't get over for a while. But you have a chance to rewrite that and go for Moody, Franz, Springer, Zaire, all these guys who are going to give you a real shot to add plus value and just shore up your wing rotation. You can never have too many wings.
And to be clear, like I want to talk about the point guards today clearly because it's what people are going to, if people are interested in it already, and as we get closer to the draft, I think people are going to obviously gravitate towards that position when they're thinking about the Knicks. But like, I agree with you in the sense that, look, if they're sold on a guy, I'll trust, you know, Walt Perrin, the whole, all that. But like, do I, like looking through all of the possible point guard options for the Knicks next year, I think there's this temptation to be like, all right, we got to build the foundation of the next 10 years. Like right now we got RJ. Nope. That's not how you build NBA teams. It's not what the Knicks should be thinking. I'm happy we did this because this, again, we get a sense that really there's no concept of a sure thing point guard that you could just like draft him and then it's a couple of years and it's going to work. Like that clearly is not the case. So, you know,
And you know, you need to properly identify your rebuilding timeline. And this isn't to say that I don't think the Knicks can compete anytime in the near future, but Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown aren't going anywhere.
No.
Kevin Durant, Kyrie Irving, and James Harden are not going anywhere. Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons aren't going anywhere. So you need to be realistic about identifying your window to compete. And why are we rushing a rebuilding process that for the first time in 10 years, we actually have some real footing on? I'm just not in the headspace to rush that. Let's take it slowly. Picks.
The tough part is like you're the tanking days are like you're not getting any more top five picks, but that does not mean that you have to swing for the fences on a particular position in a particular draft. And I think you talked about them before to reference the Spurs, other organizations have done this. Toronto's been very good at it. There's been a few that are really good at it to just draft guys who are like, this dude has a really high ceiling. And it may not help us today, it may not help us tomorrow, but it will help us in the long run if we take this player, which is why I was so happy you said Zaire. Maybe he turns out to be great, maybe he turns out to be terrible. I don't know. But like that's a guy that if they took that dude and took a swing on that dude, I would be so impressed. I would be absolutely floored, and I hope they do. So yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and just going with those wings would signal philosophy from the front office that I'd be very encouraged by. And, yeah. And like, I'll leave everyone with this. Like, the ending to my Franz Wagner piece was something along the lines of this. It was how many, I can't remember the exact wording of it, but it was, I was like very proud of it. One of the more well thought out and like, all the time I have these like philosophy thoughts and I can't figure out how to actually express them. And this one I was like, okay, I actually got out what I was trying to say. And it was basically like how many teams have just ruined and tarnished their rebuilding process because they kept swinging for the fence for that stud guy instead of adding positive infrastructure around them. And then the next question was how many teams have actually gotten their guy yet it's been so flawed and hasn't worked out because of the lack of positive infrastructure already in place to help them. There's very few Luka Doncic's. Like very few guys are just going to come in no matter what's around them and just be a clear cut stud from day one. Usually rookies need a positive environment. And so with the Knicks right now, we have a very good piece in RJ Barrett. Emmanuel Quickly is going to be something. Julius Randle is an all-star. Let's continue to add. Like we have things now. Let's continue to add to that. So when we do identify our guy, he actually has a good ecosystem around him and can flourish from day one.
Well, and just I'll finish up the thought even further. If you look at, you know, it's funny. I think in some ways, Donovan Mitchell was the worst thing to happen to like talking about drafts because he went 13th, right? And he is doing, and it's also funny because if you look at Donovan Mitchell and you look at his efficiency and you actually, he's not Dame or Steph, but they make it work in Utah, right? They make it work. And that's its own case. And most of the time, the guys that are falling, I feel like in drafts that slip are, you know, it's like you said, it's wings, right? And let's see if we could take this lump of clay. Like, so yeah, I mean, I hope you're right. And I hope they have, you know, unless again, maybe if they think they have their version of Donovan Mitchell and they could create the right, you know, we'll see. But yeah, it's going to be interesting. Like you've used that word a few times. It's going to be interesting.
Very interesting. Thank you so much for having me on, John. This was a ton of fun.
Oh, it was a blast.
Always love talking draft, and especially with the Knicks.
Yeah, let's plan on doing one more after the lottery, and we'll maybe get, you know, a couple weeks before the draft so we could really hone in. Maybe, I don't know, maybe we'll fuck around and do a mock draft or something.
I'm all in.
I know I said it at the beginning, but just tell folks at home one more time where they could find you.
So you can follow me on Twitter at Jake in the Paint. You can go on my website, see pieces I've been referencing and subtly plugging throughout.
You're very good at that. I'm terrible at it.
It just kind of flows off the tongue. My dad always messes with me about that. He's like, how many times are you going to tell people you wrote about Jared Butler? And I'm like, every time I talk about him. And so you can find those pieces on my website at jakeinthepaint.com. Prep to Pro podcast. We're on all platforms, Apple, Spotify. We've been trying to, both of us are very busy right now, Max with work and college, me with college and whatever I'm doing on the side, but we're trying to be more diligent about getting episodes out. And of course, Henry and I are hosting a weekly show on Locker Room App, which honestly was a blast last week. We had a ton of fun. The Locker Room App's awesome because you can come in, ask us questions. We see it in the chat and it's really fun.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit more casual. We're just talking about it before I hopped on this pod. We have a couple guys we want to hit on, but it's up to whoever's listening and they'll tell us who to talk about and we'll answer all those questions. So you can tune into that on every 9 p.m. Eastern every Wednesday.
Do yourself a favor if you're listening to this. Go follow Jake on Twitter because you're going to be happy you did. He's really good and you're going to be a lot smarter about this draft. And go listen to his pod, go check out his locker room. Jake, you're the man. And everybody else out there, thank you for listening to another episode of the show. And we'll be back with you very soon. Adios.